elections will come to order. Today's Thursday, March 12th. Senator Eakin moves the minutes from the March 10th meeting. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Carlson, we have Senate File 214 in front of us today. To your bill, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair, for something else, too, for the incredible education I've gotten from carrying this bill that you carried last year. This has been amazing. I have not carried, members of the committee, I've not carried a bill that's had such controversy that has grown out of nothing ever in my Senate career so far. Senate File 214 would be called an agency bill, except that there's a few changes in it to make things better that I do support. And I guess I need to say what it's not first. It is not a gag act. It does not prevent any kind of communication that comes out from organizations that are either organized for as membership organizations or organized for advocating particular types of communications. And it does not restrict any free speech whatsoever. There are a lot of misconceptions that have been, sent around in emails and in letters that this does prevent some kinds of communications. And I guess I want to say right away that there is no First Amendment restriction. There is no Second Amendment restriction. That organizations that have memberships can still communicate anything they wish to their members. They can communicate information on new laws. They can communicate scorecards. They can communicate reporting on current happenings of legislative session. They can communicate any types of court challenges, anything that relates to the subject. Now, the restriction that begins is what's called advocacy. There's some words that are being put in here to define advocacy, and also there's some, you could probably say, relationship information that's put into statute here that defines pieces of literature that are put out near an election that a reasonable person would only understand as being put out because the intent is to affect the election. With me here are several people that can explain it, and as a testifier would be Board Chair Christian Sandy, who would give the position of the board, which strongly supports this legislation. And so I'll ask Mr. Sandy to come up to testify to the committee.
Mr. Sandy, I believe you're the vice chair of the committee, if that's correct. I know that Mr. Beck was out of town, but we appreciate you being here. And if you'd please state your name for the record first.
Yes, Madam Chair, members, my name is Christian Sandy, and I am vice chair of the Campaign Finance Board. I'm here just to give you some background on Senate File 214 and the position of the board. One of the primary purposes of the board is to make information available to the people of Minnesota so that they can make informed decisions about their government. Prior to my appointment for the board, many members of the committee will remember that I worked as a campaign finance and election lawyer for 15 years in private practice. Since being appointed to the board, I haven't taken any of those types of cases. But what I can tell you is the observation that for most of those years, the law dealt with campaign spending limits and what restricted campaign spending and disclosures. Now, after the Citizens United decision from the Supreme Court in 2010, the law has really changed its focus to disclosure and how people can learn about money that is being spent that is no longer restricted. And in Minnesota, we're seeing an increasing amount of undocumented and undisclosed political expenditures. that are geared toward influencing elections and political decisions. So for the past 3 years, the Minnesota Campaign Finance Board has supported what we believe is reasonable and a non-invasive expansion of Minnesota's disclosure laws to sweep in these undocumented expenditures. The bill before you has bipartisan support on the board. It has always had bipartisan support on the board, even as the membership of the board has changed over the past 3 years. So we believe that this bill, as it stands, will help to start inform Minnesotans about political spending that is undocumented and undisclosed, but still has an impact on political decisions as they occur in Minnesota. And I do have one final comment. As an administrative agency and also as a member of the board, I'm appointed by the governor, and I'm confirmed by a supermajority of both houses of legislature. It's the only political position in Minnesota that is like that. So my colleagues on the board and I tend to be cautious about weighing in on policy matters that are really in the jurisdiction of the legislature. In this case, however, I'm mindful of its Minnesota statute section 10A02 subdivision 8 that states specifically that the board can offer legislative recommendations. And because of that, and from what I've said, the fundamental law of campaign finance has changed from when Chapter 10A was originally written and enacted to be one more disclosure and less of restriction. So because of that, my colleagues on the board and I believe this legislation serves the overarching goal of informing the public of the sources of political dollars, the uses of political spending, so that the people of Minnesota can make informed decisions about their government. And that's why we've weighed in on this one piece of legislation. So if there's any questions, I'm happy to stand for them, or if you'd like to call me back after you've heard some other folks. We also have our executive director who can speak specifically as to the details of legislation. But it is important that, from my perspective as vice chair of the board, for you to understand why we're weighing in on this, and also for the members of the legislature to understand that this legislation does have bipartisan support. It has always had bipartisan support from the members of the board.
Thank you, Mr. Sandy. Senator Carlson, how would you like to proceed? Do you want to hear from Mr. Goldsmith now or move on?
Yes, Madam Chair. Mr. Goldsmith is prepared to go through the elements of the bill and also give some examples of what it will affect.
Chair, I'm going to step back, but if I'm here, if you need to call me back for anything.
Great. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Mr. Goldsmith, welcome back to the subcommittee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a pleasure to be here. I will try to be as brief as I can, but I do want to give you just a bit of overview to bring forward what Mr. Sandy said. Things really have changed.
And Mr. Goldsmith, I'm sorry to interrupt, but will you just state your name, please?
Gary Goldsmith, Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. Thank you. I provided a few things in your packet, and I just want to touch briefly on a couple of them. You'll find in your packet a grid that is titled Highest Cost House Elections 2014, and this really gives you some insight into how things have changed. As Vice Chair Sandy pointed out, these are the top 10 highest costing House elections last year, and as you can see, the top one is almost $1 million, and there are several that are up there quite high. If you were to compare the amount of independent expenditures to the candidate expenditures in those top three, more than 80% of the spending is through independent expenditures. And in the 10B election, 89% of the spending was independent expenditures. So you can see that it is now independent expenditure groups, which include party units, of course, but also outside independent expenditure groups that are really controlling the message that voters get in the election. And the problem that the Campaign Finance Board sees with that is the same problem that the Supreme Court in Buckley versus Valeo recognized back in the 1970s, and that is that voters are entitled to have information about the sources of money that is being used to influence their votes. Because what this all comes down to is influencing a person's vote. And so the provisions of the bill that the Campaign Finance Board has recommended are designed to foster that right of the citizens to know who's trying to influence their vote so that the citizens can then better evaluate the message and determine based on the interests of the speaker whether that message is one that they want to follow or one that they might want to disregard. I will briefly point to another document in your handout, which you can study on your own, but it is a colored graph with a bar graph at the top and a pie chart at the bottom. The chart at the top identifies the sources of money used for independent expenditure committees and funds. These are these new committees and funds that were recognized after Citizens United. They can take corporate money. They can take federal PAC money. They can take really almost any money except for a foreign national. And those groups get, first of all, the first column is money from other independent expenditure funds, so there's some churning there. But the more important one is the middle one, the light blue one. This is money that comes in from unregistered associations. So these are groups that do not have a registration with the board. We don't really know very much about them, and there is a statute in place to provide some underlying disclosure of where they get their money, but that's one of the problems in the current statute that the bill proposes to deal with. Now, the pie chart at the bottom is really looking at the components in that blue bar at the top, these unregistered associations that are giving money to groups registered with us, and it is looking at where they get their money, so we call that the original source or an underlying source. And if you study it on your own, you'll see that of the $6 million, we know where $1.13 million comes from, either individuals or businesses, and the remaining $3.2 million, we don't know where it comes from. It is either unitemized because of the way the formulas work that determine what you have to itemize, or it is from other unregistered associations, so one step further up that ladder of unregistered organizations. And so one provision of the bill would assist in tightening up the formulas that are used for this underlying source disclosure, and I'll elaborate that on a bit when we get to that provision. If there are no questions at this point, I will turn to the bill itself. Madam Chair and members, the bill really has three major sections and then some sections that just are conforming. And the first major section is actually Section 1 of the bill. This, and by the way, this bill passed the Senate, including the Senate floor, 2 years ago, with these provisions in it, and they were stripped out in a negotiation in conference committee with the other body. In the bill that passed 2 years ago, the language that you see in Section 1 was passed by the Senate intact. In other words, the new language starting on line 1.14 was in that bill that was passed on the Senate floor. And this deals with expressly advocating, and the reason expressly advocating is important is because it's how independent expenditures are defined. So an independent expenditure requires two things. One, it has to be independent in every way from the candidate. And two, it has to expressly advocate for the election or defeat of a candidate. Now, over the years, the courts have looked at what expressly advocating means and under what circumstances you can require disclosure about independent expenditures. And it's been clear for a long time that if you say vote for or vote against someone, certainly we can require disclosure of that kind of communication. But as soon as the court recognized that so-called magic word standards, people started avoiding it by putting out publications that just skirted quite around the words vote for or vote against. And the courts and the federal government recognized that for all purposes, for every purpose, these were nothing different than express advocacy because no reasonable person could conclude that they were anything other than express advocacy. And in fact, it was Chief Justice Roberts who wrote the standard that's incorporated into paragraph 2 of this section on line 1.14, recognizing that if you put out a communication that is so clear that no reasonable person could conclude that it's anything other than advocacy for or against a particular candidate's election, that's going to be subject to disclosure as well. And so what this provision would do is to bring those few communications that don't say vote for or vote against, but are so clear that they are express advocacy into our disclosure system. Now, they don't happen very often because people either do express advocacy and then report it, or they're further away from that line by saying, call Senator Carlson and tell him to stop doing something or start doing something. Those things are not the functional equivalent of express advocacy because they can have some other interpretation. In other words, to get Senator Carlson to do something or to stop doing something. I have included in your packet one example of something that would be, in fact, the functional equivalent of express advocacy, and you'll see it. It's a piece of literature for the candidate Sheila Keeney. She was a candidate in the primary election in the other body. If you look at the side with the mailer piece, with the mailing label section, it says liberals like Obama and Franken don't want Sheila, don't let them win, plan ahead and vote early. And then it tells you how to vote, and it tells you some things about her on the other side.
Mr. Goldsmith,
yes?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'd just like to point out to the committee that it says early voting has already started. To my point about our early voting provision that has already moved through this committee, this is my point exactly, that campaigns and parties are conveying to voters that we have a system of early voting in Minnesota, which we do not have. So I'm taking you away from your point here, but I just wanted to point that out to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think they were confused with no excuse absentee voting and early voting, but the point was they clearly wanted the reader to get out and vote, and it's clear who they wanted the reader to vote for. And yet they don't say vote for Sheila Keeney. And this actually came to the board in an investigative posture, and the board looked at it, and the board determined that under its current approach and under the current legislative language, it did not quite meet the requirement of using words of express advocacy because they managed to leave the word for out of there. And while it's clearly implied, it's not explicit. And so this provision would cure that problem. It won't affect very many pieces, but it is an important piece to make Minnesota's disclosure statutes more robust. Now, there are people who in previous years objected to this, and their objections were that it was too vague, that somehow they would be tripped up and end up, and in fact it was primarily corporations objecting to this, that they would somehow be trying to do a communication that was close to this but they thought was on the other side, and that they would trip up and it would be a contribution to the candidate that was involved and therefore a prohibited corporate contribution. And my response to that then and now is, if they're coordinating with the candidate in the first place, it's probably a contribution anyway, because the first thing to make your piece an independent expenditure is don't coordinate or cooperate with the candidate. So if they're cooperating with a candidate and making a piece that looks like campaign literature or looks like it might be to influence an election, it probably is. So I think that the idea that this is somehow going to cause corporations to inadvertently make contributions to candidates is not a valid argument. Even Senator Newman, who, as you all know, does not favor adding authority or power to state agencies, acknowledged in committee in previous years that the reasonable person standard is a well understood and recognized standard in the judicial system. His concern, which you'll probably hear in the next committee, is that maybe the decision should be made somewhere other than the campaign finance board. But the administrative agency system that Minnesota has would place it here, and I think that the standard is clear. It will affect some pieces, and I think that corporations should not be concerned about inadvertently making donations to candidates because they shouldn't be coordinating with candidates anyway. That is Section 1. The next two sections are conforming changes just to add electioneering communications to other parts of the statute where it would be appropriate. The next actual section of substance is Section 4, beginning on page 4. And this is, in fact, the electioneering communications section. And I want to say that this has changed quite a bit over the from the first year, 2 years ago when it was introduced. It changed quite a bit between then and last year. I think it is essentially the same this year. And I want to acknowledge that many of those changes were as the result of interest groups, including Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life, who's here today. And those were changes for the better, in my opinion. I think there is room for some additional change. I've read Ms. Rao's publication today, and she makes at least one point that I think was simply something that we omitted, that we should have changed when we proposed the bill last year, and there's room for some movement in another section, and I'll mention that as we go through the bill. Generally, electioneering communications are communications that identify a candidate, so you have to have a clearly identified candidate by name, and then there are a whole lot of other limits placed on them. First of all, they must be made within 30 days of the primary or 60 days of the general election. So for the non-election year and the other days of the election year, there is no such thing as electioneering communication. And so this statute would not affect that type of communication. Now, it would still affect independent expenditures, express advocacy, but electioneering communications is different than express advocacy. As I mentioned, it typically takes the form of the publication that says to call a member and tell that member to do or to stop doing something. That's typically an electioneering communication if it falls within the time frame. Now, some senators, including Senator Carlson here, have been finding out that their constituents are getting those kinds of mailings even now. Those are not electioneering communications because they don't fall within the time frame. And under this bill and under current Supreme Court jurisprudence on the First Amendment, those would not be subject to disclosure.
Madam Chair?
Senator Limmer.
One question on your last comment. If it's not in the allotted time frame, would it be considered campaign material at all?
Mr. Goldsmith.
No, Senator Limmer, or Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, it would not. The only thing that is always subject to disclosure is either the independent expenditure or a communication that is coordinated with the candidate. Now, if a piece that we're talking about, call Senator Carlson and tell him to do something, is coordinated with Senator Carlson's opponent, if they're consulting together, there is a chance that that could be an expenditure a contribution to the opponent. But assuming it's done independently, they would simply be outside of the campaign finance system.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Would that mean that anyone could print a publication, disperse it into a community, not put any indicia on it, and condemn the actions of a legislator that's in office? Is that a campaign material? Is it not? I can see that if we don't have any restriction on it, it very well could be, and it would be in the form of building a case for the eventual campaign piece within the time allotted that's recognized in this bill. And we're not going to recognize that other material prior to the time allotment?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, unfortunately, I have to say we probably are not going to recognize that. First of all, let me clarify that in these cases we're talking about associations that are not political committees, so their primary purpose is not to influence elections. If they're a political committee or party unit or candidate committee, we capture everything. So we're talking about interest groups or other groups who have some other primary mission, but they engage in political communication from time to time. It's not their major purpose. The court has said that we have to err on the side of those organizations' right to free speech when we decide whether something is going to come into a disclosure system or not. And so far, the court has said that our boundaries are, before we can bring in their communications, are that it must be express advocacy or the functional equivalent, or it must be within that time frame that is more relevant to an election, the 30 days and the 60 days. So unless it fits one of those two things, or unless we were able to establish that the primary purpose of the organization was to influence elections, it would not be subject to disclosure.
Senator Limmer.
Well, Madam Chair, would that mean that your organization would determine whether or not that was designed to influence the outcome of an election, even though it's outside of the time limit, it would be your organization, or who would make that decision?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, mostly there is not going to be a decision that needs to be made. If it's outside of the time frame and it doesn't meet the definition of independent expenditure, in other words, saying vote for or being something like this piece that is so clear that it can have no other purpose, then it's simply not subject to disclosure. The fact that it might coincidentally have some effect on an election is insufficient to raise the question. It has to be either express advocacy or within the time frame, and so there would be no question for the board to address.
Madam Chair,
I'm sorry, Senator Limmer.
I've been through a couple election cycles, and there's oftentimes a strategy by those who are either for or against a candidate to very early in a campaign year, for lack of a better term, soften the ground. And it's kind of like carpet bombing. You raise lots of questions about the integrity of a candidate. Or for the other part of it, you might be very laudatory toward a candidate in order to strengthen that candidate's name in a district. It's very strategic. It's designed to affect the election. But if I just said that Senator Hoffman's a great guy 800 times in the summer of an election, although maybe somebody may not believe my integrity over that, but nevertheless, I could say it enough times that it would convince a few independently minded people that maybe that's true. Or I could say the opposite, and without saying anything more, Is that for the intent of for a campaign purpose or not? And just giving someone a compliment, or maybe raising a doubt, or who knows what it could be? I could say 800 times that Senator Hoffman hates puppies, and that might be enough to convince that narrow margin of victory to be overturned in the next election. So. I would think that anything said in an election cycle, in election year, especially a repeat message, would be considered a campaign message and should be under the auspices of your review board.
Well,
but in this proposal, that's not there.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, your example is excellent because I've been using actually a much easier example, that is to call someone and tell them to do something. That, a reasonable person could say, is designed to make the senator change his mind. Your example is much more complex and much more on the line between express advocacy and something else. And so the question, as you've recognized, would be whether a reasonable person could conclude that either a single communication or that stream of communications serves some other purpose than to influence the election. And your actual question was whether that would be under the jurisdiction of the Campaign Finance Board to determine, and the answer to that would be yes, it would be. And the question then would be, is there a reasonable interpretation for this stream of communications other than to influence the election that is going to occur at some point in the future? And if the answer is no, there is no reasonable interpretation, then that would be considered a piece of express advocacy subject to disclosure and potentially a registration requirement. I would point out that anybody who is agreed by or disagrees with the board's approach or conclusion in a matter does have the right to bring the matter to the Office of Administrative Hearings in a contested case form. I think in the 40 years of the board's existence, we've had one or maybe two of those. Typically, our decisions have not been challenged, but that is an option as well. But yes, that would be a decision the board would make.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, thank you. And just for the record, I do like puppies, Senator Limmer. I have a dog bill out there for trapping, so if you want to put that into something written, then that could be implicit in reasonable interpretation of something. So
think about it.
Mr. Goldsmith, back to the bill, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So we've established that it has to be 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general election. I will point out, well, let me just continue through the bill. Starting on line 4.33 are exclusions. These are things that no matter when they are done will not count as election and communications. And one of the important ones is a fairly long one beginning on line 5.3, which is the nonpartisan voter guide. This provision was added based on the work of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits and many of the 501c3 charitable organizations. Some of them do this type of voter guide. The description of how it works has essentially been developed by the IRS, and the IRS says you can do these voter guides without losing your nonprofit charitable status, and so we've modeled the language after that. And so this, I've read some material that some people argue this tells them what kind of voter guide they have to do. Not at all. This tells them that if you do this kind of voter guide, which is a balanced voter guide that doesn't tip off people as to how you want them to vote, if it really is a voter guide, it is not electioneering communications. It will not subject you to disclosure or any kind of regulation by the board. On the other hand, if you do a voter guide that in those 30 or 60 days that sort of indicates pretty clearly or that not even indicates clearly, if you do a voter guide that's not a nonpartisan voter guide during the relevant time, it would be subject to disclosure. There's another exclusion that's important. It starts on line 5.31, but the important part is really on line 6.1. It's an exclusion for any communication that is made when the legislature is in session, and that would include a special session, or within 10 days after the last day of the regular session. So if the primary gets moved up so it somehow bumps up toward the session end date, organizations will still have the full session and 10 days after that to thank legislators for what they've done or scold them for what they didn't do that they should have done. So there's that protection that for those who really are doing that kind of communication, and there are some that are doing it because they want to recognize legislators, positively or negatively, they will still be able to do that, and it will not trigger an electioneering communications requirement. One of the important factors to determine whether something is an electioneering communication is whether it is targeted to the relevant electorate. This doesn't just apply to every communication, and that's subdivision 2 on line 6.11. And we accomplish a couple of important things by defining targeted to the relevant electorate, and this is one of the places where I would suggest an amendment that Ms. Rao essentially has suggested. And what we did was we tried to exclude, first of all, we excluded member communications, and it was our intention to exclude really all member communications that are directly from the organization to the members. And so on line 6.17, first of all, you have to establish a certain number of count of your distribution of these communications pieces. And line 6.17 says when you're counting, if it's printed material, email, text messaging, and this is where it should also include telephone communications. I fully agree with that. You do not count contacts with your members. And so at some appropriate time, to clarify what was actually the intent when we drafted this bill, which was to exclude direct member communications, I would suggest at line 6.18, after the comma following the word material, to insert telephone communications, comma. And that would make the bill reflect what was the intent when we put this exclusion in and address one of a constituency's concerns.
Senator Carlson, is that an amendment that you would like to offer?
Madam Chair, yes, if at the right time, I would like to do that. Yes.
If council could please repeat that language.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment would be on page 6, line 18, after the first comma, insert telephone communication, comma.
On that amendment, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes. Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Excuse me, Senator Limmer.
Mr. Goldsmith, on lines 613 and 616, I might be getting ahead of you, but there's a reference to a number of persons in districts. such as on line 13, 1,500 persons in the district candidate seeks to represent. And then they have in the case of a candidate for House of Representatives, Senator, District Court, by more than 6,000 persons. Could you explain to me how you arrived at those numbers? And they don't appear to be directly proportional to the size of a district. So I'm kind of curious how you arrived at that number.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, certainly Senator Limmer. First of all, just for clarification, the 1,500 is 1,500 or more persons in the district the candidate seeks to represent in the case of a candidate for House, Senate, or District Court, and 6,000 for statewide offices. Those are, to be honest, somewhat arbitrary, but based on an extrapolation of the numbers used in the federal law that relates to the same topic and extrapolating from the size of districts in the federal law. Now, certainly, if someone wanted to tailor these more finely, there could be a difference in House district versus Senate district would be the most logical next step. These were put in place to capture the idea that it has to be a fairly significant mailing. I mean, if you're going to mail something to 20 or 30 or 50 or a couple hundred people, that's going to be excluded. But if you're mailing to 1,500, that seemed to be significant enough to bring into the disclosure system.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I would think that in a state Senate district, a number of 6,000 persons, is that the appropriate number that would align itself with the state Senate district? To me, it just seems like a very low bar.
Senator Limmer, for the state Senate, it's 1,500 people. And then for a statewide office, it's 6,000.
So it's the same standard, Madam Chair, for a House district as it is a Senate district?
Correct.
As it is for a judicial court district?
Correct.
Judicial court districts take up many, many counties of electorate, whereas a state representative district is, by comparison, rather small. And the same standard of number for the two different districts. There's judicial districts that are almost the size of a congressional district once you get out state. So I'm curious why we have one standard for a very wide range of district sizes. Doesn't seem proportional to me.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, thank you. I agree with you, and I would be happy to work with Senator Carlson and with you to come up with some numbers that actually are more proportional to the various sizes of districts we're talking about. From an administrative standpoint, it's not difficult for us. It might be add some slight difficulty for the reporters, although people who are affecting legislative races are often not affecting judicial races, and communications don't usually mix very much, but that certainly could be worked on. And I would be happy to do that.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, Mr. Goldsmith, you referred to a federal law. What federal law was that you were referring to determine these numbers?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I can't give you the cite of the law, but it's the Federal Electioneering Communications Statute, which also uses the concept of targeted to the relevant electorate.
All right.
And Mr. Goldsmith, just to clarify, the person or organization doing the communication is required to report to the board under this proposal how many people they're contacting?
Madam Chair, no, they're not required to report how many people they're contacting. If they meet the threshold, then they would provide information similar to what a political committee would provide. That is, who did they pay for the material? How much did they pay? And in some cases, where did the money come from?
So, in other words, it's not necessarily the number of people, but after they reach the 1,500 threshold in the case of a legislative race, then they would report.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
To the bill, then, Mr. Goldsmith.
Yes. Another exception that's quite important that was also added because of the interest groups is found in Part B at line 6.20. Again, this is part of what is targeted to the relevant electorate. The issue was that groups distribute literature, leaflets, booklets, and so on in lots of different ways. They do it at county fairs. They do it at churches and social events and in people's homes, all kinds of ways. And the intent was not to bring that type of distribution into the disclosure system. So that's what this exception does. When you're talking about any printed materials other than signs or billboards or published advertisements, but in other words, lit of any kind, it's targeted to the relevant electorate only if it is distributed to the voters either by the U.S. mail or to the resident's home or business, namely through a lit drop. So you have to actually do a mailing or a drop like you would in a regular campaign before your literature will be part of an electioneering communication.
So, Mr. Goldsmith, if an organization wants to flyer windshields at a church on the Sunday prior to an election, would that meet this threshold?
It would not, because it's not delivered to the voter's residence. Continuing with the bill, the next section relates to disclosure, and I won't go over it section by section unless people have specific questions. Rather, I will explain what it does. There are two ways that campaign-related activity is disclosed. In Minnesota, actually, there's only one way. And that is, there's a registered entity, it's a political committee or fund typically, and they file periodic reports. In the federal system, that's not the only way. There is also what's called event-based reporting or event-triggered reporting, where when a group does something and meets a certain threshold, that will trigger a reporting or disclosure requirement. And actually, the board was sued on its regular campaign finance reporting statute, arguing that our timed reporting, our scheduled reporting, was too burdensome. And the organization that sued us argued that event-triggered reporting was the appropriate method of reporting, so that an agency or an organization, rather, doesn't have to follow a schedule. They just monitor their spending, and each time they meet the threshold, they file a statement. And so, actually, personally, I don't think that would be easier for me. I like scheduled things. What we've done in this bill is give them either option. So at subdivision 3 on line 6.24, the first thing it says, if you're already a registered committee, you file in the normal way. And then Part B on line 6.28 says, if you're not a political committee, you can establish a political fund for your electioneering communications and report like others on a schedule rather than having to keep track of each time you meet this trigger for reporting. However, Part C incorporates the full concept of event-based reporting that allows this organization to not ever register. They keep records, but they already keep records. They are typically nonprofit corporations, so they have a lot of record-keeping requirements. And then they report on a simple statement whenever they meet the threshold. So it might be only once during the whole year, or it might be multiple times during the year. And the statement itself, first of all, if they don't spend $1,500, they don't have to do anything. That's another trigger. You can do electioneering communications and even meet the thresholds, but if it doesn't cost you $1,500, you never have to do anything. But once you meet that $1,500 threshold, then you would file a statement that is similar but somewhat simpler than a campaign finance report. You would identify who you paid and when and how much, and then in some cases you would identify your sources of money, and that's sort of the next topic that I will talk about. The topic of where you get the money, where these organizations get the money and how they disclose it is somewhat confusing, or in some cases I think organizations, none that I've seen in this room, but other organizations have misinterpreted it and think that Somehow this bill is at some point going to make them require, make them disclose all their donors or all their donors over some small amount. That's not the case. What the bill says, and the last section deals with independent expenditures, but this section deals with electioneering communications. The bill says if you meet the threshold so that you have to disclose, you identify how much money you spent on electioneering communications. And then you identify what percentage of all of your money that was. And these are often nonprofits, so it's never going to be more than 50% or they'll lose their nonprofit status. But for the sake of worst-case scenario, let's assume that the organization uses 50% of its money for electioneering communications. It would then attribute each of its donors' donation, 50% of each donor's donation, to its electioneering communications effort. And then after making that multiplication, it would itemize donors of more than $5,000. So if you work through the math, a person would have to give more than $10,000, and the organization would have to spend more than half of all of its money before that donor would be disclosed. So from a practical standpoint, for an organization that's pushing the boundaries with the IRS, no donor of $10,000 or less would ever be disclosed. And from an actual practical standpoint, if they're spending, say, 25% of their money on electioneering communications, no donor of more of less than $20,000 would ever be disclosed. So there is simply no way that a small donor will ever be disclosed. The effect of this bill, if passed, will be that if there's an organization that has a few very large donors, there's a good chance those donors will be identified, and that's consistent with the Supreme Court's recognized state interest in informing voters of who's trying to influence their votes. Now, we're not interested in all these small donors because they're not significant enough to have real influence, but if you have million-dollar donors funding these kinds of communications, the Supreme Court recognizes the state's right in providing its voters with information about those sources.
Mr. Goldsmith, just in the interest of time, because we still have a couple or at least one, two other people who want to testify, if you could please continue through at a little quicker pace.
I think that really actually covers almost all the important parts, Madam Chair. There is a disclaimer or statement of attribution requirement that you would have to put the prepared and paid for language on the material. And then finally, the last section is the independent expenditure section. I spent a little bit longer talking about allocating back to original donors because that's the same concept that's in the last section for independent expenditures. The law right now would allow an organization to allocate $5,000 to each donor, and that could shield the highest donors. And by requiring a proration among donors, it will still shield all of the small donors, all the donors of $10,000 or $20,000 and below, but it would no longer shield the million-dollar donors. And so that's the purpose of that part of the bill. And I'm concluded. If there are questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. We appreciate your leadership on this issue, certainly. The next person on the agenda is Joan Sullivan from the League of Women Voters. Ms. Sullivan, welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the tape.
And then Thank you. My name is Joan, J-O-A-N, Sullivan from Shoreview, and I'm a member of the League of Women Voters, Minnesota.
Thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Despite Minnesota's strong culture of civic engagement, I think most of us recognize that the systems that fuel Minnesota's democratic processes are in need of attention. The influence of money in politics represents a threat to the health of our democracy in Minnesota and nationally. Almost all, 95% of Americans think that money in politics is a huge problem. But almost everyone thinks nothing can be done. We have to do something. The League's position is that methods of financing political campaigns ensure the public's right to know, as Mr. Sandy emphasized. combat corruption and undue influence, enable candidates to compete more equitably for public office, and allow maximum increased citizen participation in the political process. So by limiting disclosure of an independent expenditures to communications only using the current magic words of advocacy, Minnesota law does not ensure the public's right to know or allow candidates to compete equitably. As many of you know, advertisers can easily communicate their messages without using the magic words of express advocacy, and we've all seen that today with Mr. Goldsmith's examples. Another important point to keep in mind is that Minnesota still lags behind 25 other states in the country by not requiring disclosure of electioneering communications, which influence voters, sometimes, often, without the candidate's knowledge. Evaluating disclosure laws for independent spending in 50 states, the National Institute on Money and State Politics is still giving Minnesota an F because our state does not yet require this disclosure. Determining how much money is spent for elections remains elusive, the Institute states again, when in Minnesota we do not require full disclosure of both forms of independent spending, the first form being express advocacy and the second electioneering communications. These failures in our disclosure system have been exacerbated by the Citizens United decision, of course, in 2010, which triggered an influx of millions of dollars into our elections in Minnesota and continues to increase by independent spenders. During the past two election cycles, we witnessed a huge surge in outside sources funding our elections in Minnesota, as far down as the local school board level. But it's impossible to know who exactly is behind these campaigns. Sometimes organizations will claim it's a burden for them to provide disclosure because of their organization's size and/or budget. Now, the League of Women Voters here is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that normally does not engage in any reportable activity in campaigns. However, in the 2012 campaign to defeat the photo ID amendment to our Constitution, we were required to disclose our contributors that time and our expenditures. At the time, we had a staff of only 3 1/3 people and a budget of less than $400,000 for that election cycle. Whatever burden we experienced in complying with the disclosure law was minimal when compared with ensuring the public's right to know and the right to know who's attempting to influence their vote. The League strongly urges you to support Senate File 214 this session. By requiring disclosure of electioneering communications, Minnesota would keep pace with the manner in which election campaigns are conducted in this century and give voters the information they need to cast an informed vote. Please close this big loophole this time. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you, Ms. Sullivan. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. The next person on the list is Jeremy Schrader from Common Cause. Mr. Schrader, welcome back to the committee. Please state your name for the record, and then you can give your testimony.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Schrader. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. I'm here to support Senate File 214, one of the most important bills before you this session. Senate Bill 214 will allow Minnesotans to know who is trying to influence their democracy and is a first step towards informing the public about the special interest money that is taking over our elections here in Minnesota and across the nation. In the famous Citizens United case, which allowed unlimited money and independent expenditures, Justice Scalia talked about the importance of disclosure. Thomas Jefferson would have said, the more speech, the better, so long as people know where the speech is coming from. Minnesota, unfortunately, is behind the times and would not even meet Jefferson's requirement. Elections on every level have gotten more expensive. You've heard a lot about the exact numbers already. I won't repeat any of that. But just to point out again that the last 2014 cycle was the first time, not just in Minnesota, but across the nation, we saw more money spent by outside sources than the candidates or the campaigns parties themselves. This is the system we have where unlimited money is allowed from undisclosed donors who could be anyone living anywhere. This is the system we have, but we need to stop and ask if this is the system we want. and what is really good for democracy here in Minnesota. And I also want to point out that you all know and feel the effects of this more than I or any member of the public who has not run for city for recently for public office, feeling the effects of people running against you, running for your own campaign, and you feel this on a very real and personal level. And what I'd like to say is Senate File 214 offers a real start for an alternative way of handling our campaigns in a way that would strengthen our democracy. 25 states already have reformed their laws to conform and adapt to the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United. And Senate File 214 would update Minnesota and allow citizens to, at the very least, know who is spending a large amount of money to influence the elections. And these reasons are important, but the situation, unfortunately, is much more dire. Right now, Congress aspires the lowest level of confidence since any institution since Gallup began asking the question in 1973. And 60% of Americans say that members of Congress are more likely to vote in a way that pleases their financial supporters, while only 20% think that the representatives would vote in the best interests of their constituents. It is a problem when people don't have faith in their democracy, and unfortunately it's gotten worse and worse over the years. The legitimacy of our democracy depends on the consent of the governed. And what happens when the money gets in the way of that? Senate File 214 is something we can do right now to stop this. I urge you to support this bill. Thank you very much for your time. I'll answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Schrader. Senator Carlson, other comments on Senate File 214? Or perhaps first I should ask, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, no one has contacted me with regard to any changes or opposition to this bill. But I do want to make some comments at the end here to make sure that we all understand this. This legislation continues the conversation from previous sessions. It expands the definition of express advocating and establishes a definition for electioneering communications. It also requires disclosure for those engaged in electioneering communications, as well as strengthens the requirement for disclosure of original sources of large money used for independent expenditures. Disclosure is important because the public has a right to know who is trying to influence how they vote. This information provides voters the ability to understand why something is said over the course of a campaign. A key point made by Mr. Goldsmith is that there is no intent whatsoever to limit the communications of a group with their members or with the public at large when an election is not imminent. Some of the claims that have been made, like modified disclosure provisions, are aimed at suppressing political speech. You've heard now that that is not correct. That new provisions are aimed at nonprofit corporations and do not affect unions. You can see that there's no differentiation between union spending and other corporations or groups. That the electioneering communication disclosure laws will affect how associations are allowed to communicate with their members. And as we've said, there's no restriction whatsoever on communication with members. That the new electioneering communication laws will prohibit interest groups from distributing literature at churches, county fairs, civic meetings, and other similar venues. And as you've heard from Mr. Goldsmith, that is absolutely not true. That will still be allowed, and it will not need to be reported. Another suggestion is that new electioneering communication laws will require membership associations to disclose all or most of their donors. And as you've heard, that is also not correct. Or that the constitutionality of the bill's provisions is in question. And you've heard that the bill's expanded definition of express advocacy was established by the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts in the case of FEC versus Wisconsin Right to Life. The other provisions have been tested in federal court and have withstood constitutional challenges. As anyone can see, the nature of educating the public is clearly protected and in no way restricted. Communications of associations to their members are unrestricted, requiring reporting, no reporting, or registry. The threshold of the responsibility to report are clearly reflected in these numbers that any administration of an association can monitor and administrate. With that, Madam Chair, I would like to move this bill for passage.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. I just have a couple of comments. For the public, sometimes the language in this legislation sounds confusing, but I think it's worth noting that the chart that Mr. Goldsmith distributed articulates why this legislation is so needed. In a day, in age where the top 10 highest House elections, state House elections, now cost in excess of $600,000 each, where the candidates' campaign expenditures are just a fraction of that cost, I think it's very timely and necessary that the state legislature and the state of Minnesota make a effort here to disclose where this money is coming from. At a very base level, this bill is just about making sure that the public has a right to know where campaign contributions that are being used to influence elections, to influence the people who sit around these tables, where that money is coming from. I think that that's well established and within our scope to do so. And attempts to stop or not support legislation that requires this disclosure is in some ways blatant attempt to distort the public's right to know who's funding our elections. So you can see my bias here, but I just think that this is reasonable legislation, that we've worked with opponents on it to take their concerns into consideration. Senator Carlson, I thank you for your willingness to work on this bill this year. I know that it's a difficult one, but I think it's really fundamental to our democracy that the public have a right to know where the campaign money is coming from. Senator Carlson.
I have one final comment that directed at Senator Limmer. If Senator Limmer would like to, I would be very appreciative if you would sign on to a bill that might even expand this. These are lift pieces that were sent out to educate the public on my behavior in the last couple of months. I have mixed feelings about them because all of the calls that we've gotten in my office have been positive, even though I don't think the intent was to be positive. So if you would like to work with me on something like this, I'm all ears. Thank you, Senator Limmer.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I was going to ask a few more questions, but since you've invited me to your bill, you didn't win me over with John Roberts' quotes. I'm not a fan, based on a few earlier landmark decisions that he did last year. But nevertheless, I do have a question on page 5, line 6 through a couple questions, 5-6 to 5-10. And if I could start at 5-9, there's a reference to clear and unbiased communication. Senator, could you tell me who would decide what is clear and unbiased?
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I'm going to have Gary, I'm going to try to interpret it first with my shot, and then have Mr. Goldsmith give his legal opinion. That I would suspect that what this would require is a complaint. Okay, if you see below there, we're talking about guides, and the guide has to have, you can't ask the question, have you stopped beating your wife? That would not be allowed unless you're given the ability to clarify your answer, like, I'm not married, something like that. So it has to be something where it has a clear and unbiased question. The question has to be clear and unbiased writing.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I think Senator Carlson generally has the concept down. This, by the way, this is part of the exclusion from electioneering communications for the nonpartisan voter guide. So this is intended to define a guide that would be outside of the disclosure system. And I think the board, when it interprets statutes, interprets them using other statutes that tell us what we have to do, and one is to use words in their ordinary meaning. So clear is pretty well defined. If you read a question and you understand what the question is, it's probably clear. Unbiased is a little bit less clear, but I think Senator Carlson gave a good example. But an example that we might see on a voter guide would be, do you support raising taxes on the top 2% to kill and thus killing jobs? That's not an unbiased question. But if that came up, it would typically be in the case, as Senator Carlson said, of a complaint filed with the board arguing that a particular guide should be considered an electioneering communication, and the board would have to make that decision, again, subject to the respondent's right to have a contested case if they saw fit.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, the comment about not beating your wife question, we actually had a candidate a few years ago who you honestly could ask that question because he had been convicted of beating his wife earlier and he was still running for office. And so it's not out of the realm of possibilities. The other question I had was going up to line 5.6. And I'm kind of concerned. Usually voter guides come from narrow focused special interest groups. They don't really care about a wide range of issues pertinent to the state of Minnesota. They're focused on their own bailiwick. And I was wondering why we would require a voter guide not to focus on a single or a narrow range of issues when that's their whole purpose. And then we would require them by government edict to provide questions or subjects sufficient to encompass major issues of interest to the entire electorate. Why, how in the world did we come up with that phrase?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, first of all, as I pointed out earlier, this doesn't require anybody to do anything. Any association can do any kind of voter guide that they want. One issue, slanted questions, green check boxes, red check boxes, that's all just fine. And in some cases, then, they will be required to consider that voter guide an electioneering communication if it meets the other requirements. This system here is to establish some standards where they can produce a voter guide that stays completely outside of the campaign finance system. These are the requirements that a nonprofit corporation would have to meet to maintain their nonprofit status through the Internal Revenue Service. These are based on the IRS guidelines and on our work with the nonprofit corporate community in implementing these types of standards in Minnesota. So nobody has to do this. But if you don't, and if you stray too far from this so that you don't meet any of the requirements, your piece is probably going to constitute electioneering communication.
Madam Chair,
Senator
this kind of reminds me of another direction that government is going in. I happen to be a licensed professional in the state of Minnesota. I sell real estate. But government now is telling me exactly what type of elective continued education course I have to take, even though I've never practiced in that area of sales or marketing. One of the examples was leasing, and I had by law had to take a course, and government is telling me what to do and what not to do in fulfilling my requirements. There are more general requirements, such as fair housing, which is a universal goal, but to go into the very specifics of a separate discipline of law, I find to be a little bit repugnant to tell me what to study on. And to include a wide range of issues, and I'm not quite sure, it doesn't say how many major issues this group is supposed to address in order to satisfy not being considered this particular type of campaign material. I find that it's beginning to border on my same feeling toward that continued education. Why are we government? Why are we the government telling people that they have to encompass major issues when it's not their issues, it's not their concerns at all? I just find it to be silly to think that we have to force people to jump through hoops
like this to create some illusion that they're not a special interest or that they are a special interest. I just find it unnecessary.
Senator Limmer.
Yes.
The way I think about this provision of the law is that if it sounds like a duck, it walks like a duck, it probably is a duck, and in that way it needs disclosure. We're not limiting that it can what the duck says or what happens to the duck. All we're saying is that if it looks like electioneering communication, if it looks like something like this where any reasonable person would assume it's a campaign attempting to influence an election, you have to add a disclosure. We're not limiting that you can do it or not. You're just saying the public has a right to know that who is behind it, who is paying for it.
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate the work that Senator Carlson has done. This is complex stuff, and I appreciate the work he does. I appreciate your opinion. But I could also use the same standard, what walks like a duck, what quacks like a duck, might just be a totalitarian duck. And quite honestly, I don't think we need to go in this direction. I think there's better ways to do it, maybe more simple. I just find that some of the stuff that I see in here, I just have to scratch my head and say, why are we doing it? Then we give it to a board to consider, but then there's an appeal process that we go away from a board and we go to a judge to get an appeal. It seems like we have a number of different standards, different applications under the law, different people that we have to appeal to if we were ever dragged in front of the tribunal. And then at the same time, then we have to have a number of other major issues to determine whether or not we're in their sights or not in their sights, when it has nothing to do with the concerns of these particular citizens.
Senator Limmer, we would welcome ideas you have for increased disclosure, if that's what you're getting at, to consider these on this subcommittee. So we would welcome your input in what we can do then to get at these big numbers that are now happening in Minnesota campaigns, and the public has no right to know where that money comes from. So if you have other ideas, we'd welcome that input. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Carlson and the Campaign Finance Board, Gary, thank you for bringing this bill. I look at a race this past year, and almost $900,000 was spent, and the difference in the votes were 36 votes. Now, I'm germane to that race because that was my sister-in-law. Transversely, in 2012, $371,000 was dropped against me in 47 lit pieces with shaded backgrounds, some guy smoking a cigar, crumbling wedding cake. I mean, some of these things were just, you can't make this up. And they all looked like legit lit pieces like this, but they were really some damaging items. I'm more than happy to bring them here to share. So I'm happy that you're going down this road and saying we're going to make a change in how we do this electioneering in Minnesota. And so thank you for bringing this conversation to this table. Thank you for bringing this conversation to the state. And thank you for now getting us back to what we should be doing is good governance in Minnesota instead of these 30-second sound bites. So I'm honored to support this bill as it goes forward.
Seeing no further, Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I just wanted to make one slight comment on what you were talking about. And those are good. Those are good comments. However, the way that I look at it, and I think the way the Campaign Finance Board is looking at it, is that section from 5.6 on referring to the scorecards is the way that a campaign can stay out of the campaign finance system. So if you do those things, you stay out of the campaign finance system. And I think that's what we needed was some definition to make sure that we don't have so many questionable pieces of literature, questionable scorecards, just to stay out of it. So if you follow that, you're out of it.
Senator Carlson moves that Senate File 214 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. A roll call having been requested, the chair...
1-1 over. But take left.
We're having a slight computer problem, but...
What would Newman do? That's what I want to know.
We should make great.
Senator Sieben?
Aye.
Senator Cohen? Senator Carlson?
Aye.
Senator Eakin? Senator Hall? Senator Hayden? Senator Hoffman?
Aye.
Senator Kiffmeyer? Senator Limmer?
No.
Senator Cohen?
Yes.
There being four ayes and one nay, the motion prevails and the bill is recommended to pass.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. There being no further business before the committee, it's adjourned.